You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Becky Mollenkamp. We talk about a time of really intense transition in her life when a relationship ended, a family member died, and she changed careers. That is a lot for anybody to go through in a short amount of time. And yet the other side of that is that many people will have times in our lives where this is sort of the exact situation that life throws at us. Becky shares the backstory of what she experienced, the choices that she made that she was aware of at the time that she had, the decisions she made as she walked through this very difficult season, some good, some not so good, and how it eventually all worked out and what life looks like today. I also get to talk to her about running, which is super fun for me. So I think you're going to love this. So let's do it. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Becky Mollenkamp, are you ready for a fun chat with me today?
You know it. Thanks for having me.
You are very welcome. I have my two warm-up questions. I start all of my interviews by asking my guests what part of the world they call home. Where are you?
I am in the middle of the U.S. in St. Louis, Missouri.
Home of the arts. I just gave one thing. But what's one thing you love about St. Louis, or at least you enjoy?
Well, it's not the arch. In addition to my family, I think I will go with the St. Louis Cardinals. I have been a lifelong fan, love going to a game on a nice day, which there aren't that many here. But when there is, it's no better place to see a ball game.
Fantastic. That is a wonderful, wonderful story. Okay, so I am going to share two things with you about your pitch before we start, which is one of the things is to let people know that you and I actually know each other a little tiny bit before. So there's that. You get a gold star for following the instructions and submitting a concise pitch. So in my instructions, I'm like, hey, give me 1 to 2 sentences. And everybody on the planet is like, here's 6 paragraphs. You did really give me 2 to 3, like a sentence and a half. And you put so much in there that it was really, really good. So you do get a gold star.
I love gold stars. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Second thing, you and I are on Zoom probably once or twice a month because we do some other stuff together. And I learned more about you in this 1.5 sentences as a person than I knew from all of those conversations. And I find that very charming.
That's shocking to me.
It really is. It shows that we're not having that kind of conversation. We're going to talk about a time in your life where everything got turned around, like a really clean slate almost kind of moment. Job, relationship, and family, big upheaval and change. This could be a country song. Are you ready to do that?
I am ready. My life definitely could be a country song. And I think my name really fits that. Becky feels very country.
It does. Or how do they classify John Mellencamp? Because he's not country. Is he country? Is he? There's rock.
He's like rock. Yeah. Rock. Americana rock.
America. I think that is it. Americana. I bet you that is it. All right. So generally speaking, let's set the time frame. When was this period of upheaval in your life? Like how many years ago? How old were you?
I can give you a very specific date. July 4th, 2010 is the date that will live in infamy in my life where I can identify specifically where it was like everything changed. But the year or so leading up to that, and then obviously the few years following that day, were all a time of serious change for me.
All right. So it's been about 15 years.
Yeah.
16 years. All right. So, 15 and a half. All right. So 3 things happened. I don't know if this is in order or if there is an order, you can correct me. You get a divorce, a member of your family dies, and you change careers. So if we think back to the time before all of this happened, so 2009, can you describe what a typical day in your life might have looked like?
I was self-employed. My partner, my ex-husband, was a pilot, so he was gone a lot because he was an airline pilot, and they work 3 to 5 days away, and then they're home usually for like an equivalent amount, kind of like firefighters, I guess. So I had a lot of alone time, which I, as an introvert, loved. And then, you know, the time that we would spend together was very like intense because we would be together all day when he was home. And I was self-employed. I was a writer slash producer for magazines. I had come out of working at Better Homes and Gardens magazine, continued to do freelance work, both writing stories and then also producing photo shoots and content you would see. And this is when they had this thing called magazines, kids, where you would actually flip paper pages and look at photos instead of just clicking buttons online. And things had started to shift with that online movement. And so things were radically changing very quickly. It was also the heels of the 08 recession, which where I was living in the Midwest hit a little later. So that was starting to really ramp up. The house, we had just built a custom home in 2007. I did not time the market well by a long shot. We paid a lot of money and lost $100,000 on a home by the time we had to sell it through the divorce. So my day at the time just looked like working. And then on the days when I was working, I would work whatever hours I wanted. I was also running a nonprofit for an animal charity. So I was doing that work. And then on the days when I wasn't working, because my partner would be home, it was, you know, doing whatever. Listen, I had a lot of money at the time. Like, this was a very different time in my life. I had lots of disposable income. I was driving a cherry red BMW into my custom home with walnut floors and, like, you know, all the bells and whistles on that, traveling whenever I wanted. Life was really good. My partner made a lot of money. I was making six figures up until right around that recession started to hit. And bloggers started to change the world of publishing. But up until like the edges of that point, life looked really good. I kind of did what I wanted. I didn't have kids.
Very cool.
And lots of money.
Lots of money. Very good. So you were in journalism. And you were in magazine, because like print journalism,
I started in newspapers. So right out of school, I worked at a daily newspaper in California. I worked at the Napa Valley Register. Shout out to the Register. They're still trying to, you know, truck along these days. I mean, if you want to know the truth, right out of college, I got a job at the Carmel Pine Cone. People know of Carmel because of Clint Eastwood. He was the mayor for a while. Carmel was, and probably still is, one of the most expensive places in the United States. And they paid me $8,000 out of college. Now, granted, this was a different time, but the truth is, cost of living hasn't changed that dramatically since then. And I was making literally almost nothing. I had to live in Salinas over in the part of across the valley where they were doing all the farming. It's like, it smells like garlic all the time because of all of the farming. So that was my first job. I lasted 3 weeks because they fired the other two reporters a week after I got there, or 2 weeks after I got there, and told me I would now be doing the work of all three people with no pay raise. And I was fresh out of college thinking this was going to be the job. So I quit that job, moved back home, tail between my legs. Then I got a job at the Napa Valley Register, working at a daily newspaper, making, I think, $18,000. So it was still nothing, but it was more money. And I lasted a year there. It was fantastic. But at some point, it was like the cost of living in California for a Midwestern girl was just too much. Moved back home, worked in marketing actually for a little while, and then got a job at Better Homes and Gardens and moved into magazine publishing. It's never what I thought I was going to do. I had pictured myself being a foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune from a kid. That was what I was going to do. That didn't work out. For some reason, they didn't call me. And so I ended up working in magazines, and I really loved it. Actually, it was fun. It was so cool to like see a set come to life and to help create something and photograph it and all of that. But the world radically changed and print died, and I didn't want to go into broadcast. And so, yeah, the move then looked like going into marketing, because it was the next logical kind of shift.
So I feel like I should repeat those words back to you on a weekly basis. I didn't want to go into broadcasting, but that's a conversation for another day.
I know. And you know what? That's so funny, because I didn't want to go into broadcasting because I didn't want to do like TV, but now podcasting might as well be TV, right? Because we got to have a video, we got to be on YouTube. So yeah, here we are.
I mean, when you said that, I was like, that's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. Those words came out. All right. So three things happen. All right. So sometimes I categorize the conversations I have because I try to talk to people about choices and changes. And sometimes I will try and categorize these things into things we choose and things we don't. We've got three things on the list of things we're talking about today. And I'm not sure where we would do that. So how long were you married? And would you say that the divorce was your choice or something that happened outside of your choice?
10 years. Definitely my choice. My ex would agree with that. Okay. I cheated. Okay. So I'm always very, like, again, open book. I know that's not the best choice, not a good choice. It was a choice I made that I wish I hadn't. It was a choice in a moment of sort of desperation of thinking, I don't know what to do to save this, because I was really unhappy and couldn't express why. So I made a bad choice that then led to the choice of the end of my marriage. So that was definitely a choice. The death clearly was
clearly
not
a choice, right?
Yes. Clearly, and changing my career felt like less of a choice because of the market impact and everything that was happening in the industry. But it's still a choice, but it was a choice that felt a little less like I had a choice.
Yeah, exactly. No, there was probably a million choices in there minute to minute, but not probably the choice of, hey, you know, what do I want to do? What year did you come out of school? What year did you work in Carmel?
You really want everybody to know how old I am?
No, well, because
I'm kidding. 1996.
Oh, so that's the same year I graduated from school. And I always tell people that, like, so I thought I was going to work for newspapers also. And my joke is that there were jobs when I started school in 91, and there were not as many in 96. So
it really wasn't still bad for me anyway, in my experience in 96, but by 2000, and certainly by 2005, everything had changed. But when I started my job at Napa, they still didn't have pagination. Pagination came along while I was there. We got email while I was there. Like, they were still doing the good old layout. I first arrived. And so in that 1 year, they went from the old fashioned, like, pasting and printing in the back to, like, and not having a website, not having emails, nothing. You know, we barely had computers just for word processing. And in that 1 year, all of that shifted. We went to full pagination. We had email addresses. Like, we had to get a website. Like, everything shifted. It was very poor timing, my choice of career field. I mean, you know, ultimately it still serves me, which was funny because even as a coach, as a podcasting, it's obviously a more direct link, but even with coaching, I think journalism skills, it's the art of asking questions and listening, as you well know. Yep. Those are things that serve you almost anywhere.
I agree with that. People will sometimes say, not as much to me now because I don't have kids in school, but people, when I had kids that were in school, people would say in conversation, well, you know, nobody uses what they study in college. And I was like, I use what I learned in college every day, how to research things, how to have a conversation. The basic skill of how to put a message together so that other people read it, you know.
I'm a much better writer than I could have ever been if not for college. And so I'm still grateful for that time. However, when kids today say they're thinking about journalism, I do my best persuade them to consider something else.
I have a couple friends whose kids did go. I have a neighbor who studied journalism, and I was fascinated by it. And I would pepper them in the driveway. And after several conversations, I was like, I just need you to know that I'm not, like, obsessed with your child. I'm super curious what
world.
What the degree looks like now.
Yeah. And now AI and everything else. But anyway, we're going off course.
So there you go. Well, but that's kind of the point. Okay. So death can be, it was your idea to get a divorce. That's a common divorce and relationship change are a really, really common topic on the show. And also fairly common, not always, but is the, I was unhappy, but I didn't know what to do and what were my options. And so you're not alone with that at all. Death can be a tricky subject. And no matter how much time passes, and you don't have to share.
Oh, I'll share whatever I want. I've talked about a lot. My brother died of a heroin overdose, July 4th, 2010, which is why I say that's the day everything changed.
That's the day.
Leading up to that, my husband and I had already cheated. Our marriage was already in a precarious place. We were doing some counseling, trying to decide what would happen next, still with the idea that we would try to work things out. The moment my brother died, I know internally anyway, that all options for that ended, because I had that moment that I think so many people can have. He was my younger brother by 5 years. So he was 30 when he died. He left behind a couple of kids. It was very difficult. And it was that thing that I think so many people know, which is life is too short to do anything that doesn't feel right. And I was like, why am I trying to save this thing that I knew I wasn't happy? I couldn't explain why. Being unhappy when everything looks good on paper is really, really challenging, because everyone in your life is telling you, you should be happy, you should be grateful. What's wrong with you? Making it like this personal problem. And I felt that. I mean, my best friend at the time was like, you know, what's wrong with you? Like really blaming everything on me, which was an easy thing to do. I had cheated. So it was an easy sort of out to be like, well, you cheated, so you're the bad guy. And I was the bad guy because of that. However, I hadn't been happy for a year leading up to that. And I couldn't articulate why, because I had, like I said, a life that looked so good. I had all the bells and whistles. I had everything that would make a person happy. I didn't have stresses. I didn't have a horrible boss. I was my own boss. Like, there was just really nothing I could pinpoint, and I wasn't able to articulate it. So I was sort of guiltily saying, I guess I have to figure out how to make this work, right? Like I had this feeling of, I made this bed, I have to lie in it, which I think a lot of people know that and maybe have even had explicitly told to them. I know so many people who've actually had that said to them. And I was in that place until my brother died. And that was the wake up call that I needed to say, no, I may have made the bed, but I can make a new bed. Like this, I don't have to lie in this bed just because I made it. I was only 35. I mean, in my mind, I was like 70. Like I felt like that kind of like place in my life, but I'm like, I'm too young to say that I'm going to settle and the rest of my life has to look like me trying to make things work in my life. If I'm not happy, I'm not happy. And I'm allowed to just not be happy without having to even be able to tell anyone why, for it even to make sense to myself. That was really, 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 really hard. But the death, I mean, you know, obviously I would take my brother back in a heartbeat, but I am grateful every day that I got that lesson from that, right? That is something that came out of it for me, was that I got that wake up call that I don't know I would have had otherwise. My good girl conditioning ran deep. Talk about love and gold stars. I was a good girl. I did everything I could to be a good girl. And as convoluted as it sounds, in my mind, cheating was a way for me to continue to be a good girl, because I was like, if I can just try to solve this in some other way so that he doesn't have to know about, and I can still figure out some way to make this work, then I can still be this good girl who gets to say, like, all right, I'll continue to lie in this bed. I realized I don't have to do that. Like, I get to make my own rules for my life. And I don't think I could have done it without my brother's death.
So can I ask, and if it's too personal, you can tell me to bug off. Like was your brother struggling with substance use misuse that you guys knew? So you guys were living through like the family of
decades since he was 12, at least. I mean, that was at least when we know he started drinking, and had escalated over time. So he was 30. So for more than half of his life and that call was both not surprising and a complete shock, right?
Yeah.
It was, as soon as I heard my dad's voice, it was like, I knew. And yet I was in a complete state of shock. I had always known, like deep down, I always knew my brother was not long for the world. Like I knew he probably wasn't going to make it. And that was hard because I chose tough love and my parents did not. And that created rifts between us. It created obviously rifts with my brother, with my nieces. Like it was a very challenging thing to protect my own mental state. I could, at some point towards the end of his life, I had to remove myself largely from all of their lives. I couldn't be involved in it anymore. It was too painful. And what I learned from that too, by the way, for anybody who's in that boat, my mom and I both eventually we're much closer now. We both realized it didn't matter whether we chose tough love or didn't. Both of us felt guilt about it later. My mom wrestled with, maybe if I had been harder, if I tried, you know, been tougher, all of that, maybe been different. I wrestled with, I practiced that tough love and then I didn't get to like be with him at the end of his life. And we had a strained relationship at the end. Neither of us felt good. So there's freedom in knowing that. And I think we both got some freedom from that to know that it didn't matter. Ultimately, it was his addiction and his problems. And, you know, the saddest part of it was when he was overdosed, he was waiting for a bed at a rehab center. Would that have been the thing that would have saved him forever? I don't know. Nobody He'd been knows. To rehab more than once. So it wasn't like that would have been the first time, but it is awful. And just not to get way political here, but just to speak to the problems in America that we have a mental health crisis. We have a drug crisis. We stigmatize drug use, mm-hmm. which is very, very interlinked with mental health issues. My brother was bipolar. Okay. And there is not enough care. And there are people dying every day, especially at the height of the opioid crisis, which is still continuing. My brother was always the hipster. And he died sort of at the beginning of that, like of attention coming to the opioid crisis. But, you know, he died waiting for a bed and it happens every day. It happens every day in America that people are trying to get help and can't and die. And so, yeah.
Do you know the book, A Beautiful Boy?
I do. And I have read it.
Have you read the updated version?
No, I have not.
Have you heard what is in the update? I'll tell you. It's not like, I mean,
no.
You talk about like systemic troubles with mental health and resources and things. As an example, that family is very educated and had a lot of resources, financial, education, high publicity, right? They had a lot of help. With all of that, they had a movie made out of it. After all of that, the recent update at the very end is a note from the father where they finally went to a doctor who was like, hey, could you be bipolar? And finally, after all of that, that was the connection. And he is, you know, it's not an instant fix, but I mean, 15 years of in and out of the system and nobody ever put that together.
It's a shame.
I mean, really just a gut check of a, oh my gosh, it wouldn't have fixed anything, but just that you can have all the support and all the help. And it's a really, really crazy thing because like a lot of things, the entire world turns its judgment towards the parents and the family, like as if like you're not doing enough, or if you said good morning in a different way, and if you followed up on the homework more when he was in second grade, you know, maybe it would be different. And one of the things that drives me bananas about that is that there just is so much research in, and I'm not an expert or qualified to say this, but there's been research for decades that most of substance use and misuse is not tied to anything other than the fact that the person is in serious, serious pain for a variety of reasons.
It's not a willpower issue, right, which is exactly what it's often linked to, right? It's a moral judgment of a person. It is so deeply stigmatized. I compare it often to death by suicide, which is also deeply stigmatized in this country. And I often find a lot of affinity with folks who've lost relatives to suicide because they know that pain where it's like speaking about it. You can feel the judgment that comes at you in a way that is, when you tell somebody you've lost your brother to cancer, the immediate reaction is like, oh God, I'm so sorry. That must be so hard, right? Like this deep wells of empathy. When you say to someone you lost your brother to suicide and or to drug abuse, often what you get is a lot of questions about like, well, how long have they been using? What were, you know, did they have mental health? It's like just all these questions of where you feel interrogated versus just empathy for another human who's like lost someone they love. So I know, and I actually think there's a decent chance that my brother purposely overdosed that night. So I actually feel a real tie around suicide. You know, there's disagreement in my family about that, but given some of the behaviors of him that night, I think that may very well be the case. And I just know. I know the way that we treat that in America, and it is a real shame. It's a real shame, especially for the parents, even more for than the sibling, because the parents get all this additional levels of judgment of like, you obviously failed. Somehow you failed your child where we don't look at any of the parts you just talked about around the systemic issues. My brother was kicked out of school because he was a problem, right? First, he was labeled and put into, at that time, you know, this was before inclusion. So he was stuck in another room with all of the quote unquote bad kids. So of course he got worse. Then he was expelled from school. Now he's now what? Now you've got a 15-year-old who's got no hopes of like getting a job. Like, you know, and then there's issues around wealth. My parents didn't have a lot of money. They were both deeply educated. So that's helpful. We had that privilege. A lot of people don't, but we didn't have endless wells of money to be sending him to rehab or to get help. It was a different time too, where, you know, the support around even diagnoses was not there. So yeah, there's just so many things that are at play, and yet we simplify it. I always try to talk about it because that's, for me, that's a big part of the mission of talking about my brother's death and being very clear about what happened, right? Yeah. There is no, for me, like, I don't dance around it. He overdosed on heroin, right? Yeah. And I think it's important for people to know that, to hear that, and to hear from somebody who's trying to say, like, I'm not ashamed. I'm not embarrassed. I'm sad. I miss my brother. I don't blame him. I'm not, you know, like, the system failed him. And I think more people need to say that and to help remove that stigma. And every time someone does, it like warms my heart, because I think it's helping all of us in this community of people who've lost people and who will still, you know, right now, there's people out there who are going to, who will die today from heroin.
Hundreds of people will die today.
Or fentanyl. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I put those, and I'm not qualified to do this, but I put those in the same category, which I did actually ask you the question that you said. I was like, was it a surprise? And that's actually because of fentanyl, because you do now have people who are maybe not
very recreational kind of drug users.
Exactly, like really that they get a bad.
No, my brother was definitely deeply, deeply troubled and addicted.
And which the strain on your parents, like, was one of the things that happens as a parent is that if your kid veers from the mainstream in anything, you know, wants to play, you know, do something that's out of the ordinary, you sometimes find it very hard to maintain that parent network because other parents are like, oh, like it's contagious. Like I can't hang out with you because your kid might, you know,
spread. And my parents are baby boomers, as I'm sure yours are too. And I think this every generation, I do feel like these things are getting better and lessening. But, you know, for my parents' generation, that baby boomer generation, the judgment ran deep. And it was very isolating. It was very hard. And not just through that process, but following his death too, that isolation, that of that feeling of judgment. And some of it was self-isolation because I know they judged themselves, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. And you know, we don't talk like my parents absolutely suffered the most through this. But one thing I also like to talk about is I don't think that we talk enough about sibling death in this country. Like we don't talk enough about death.
We don't talk enough about death.
Right. And we talk a lot about like parents, like I think people relate to parents losing children and how hard that is and partners. But I think often siblings get overlooked and adult siblings. And I've talked to other adult siblings who've lost children when you still have parents alive. It's really challenging because you get put in this very challenging position where your own grief has to sort of be set aside because now you're playing this role of a parent losing their child's the worst thing. And I agree. Absolutely. Especially now as a parent, I can't fathom. So yes, their pain is so intense and you want to be there for them. So you're usually put in the role of making all the decisions, tending to them, everything. So it like pushes pause on your grief to a degree. You almost feel like you have to, because you've got to show up in this way for your parents. And what happened to me is I pushed pause on my grief during that time. And I then never pushed on pause. Well, not for a long time, which is why those 2 years following 2010 are all part of this unraveling for me, because I pushed pause for a long time. I had pushed it in the beginning because I felt like I had to serve, it needed to be there for them. And then I was kind of already in this place of avoiding it. So then it felt really kind of nice to not have to, like I was watching everyone else unravel and I wasn't, because I was, you know, doing that thing where I got to take care of them. And then when I finally kind of had that permission to unravel, or I would have had the spaciousness too, because I was also at that point then moving through with the divorce and everything. I was just like, it's too much. I can't. And so then I went into running mode. I ran for 2 years. I was like, I will not, if I run fast enough, this grief won't catch me. But I always tell people grief has one job and that is to be felt, and it will catch you unless you happen to die before it can. Like it's going to catch you. And it caught me and it took a long time. I outran it for a while by drinking. That was the primary thing. I was never a drinker. I'm still not a drinker. I had 2 years of incredibly heavy alcohol use because I was drinking every night to avoid having to think about it. I was sleeping around. I was out dancing and partying until 2 a.m. on weeknights. Like I did everything I could to avoid grief and it still caught me.
It does. Yeah. Do you know the word disenfranchised? That's what we call it. Yeah. So that's when you then feel like you don't have the right, it's not acknowledged, right? So it was too long. It wasn't your grief to claim. And then you don't have any of the support that you described where it's like people welcome you and walk you through the process.
Right. Yeah.
And grief is overwhelming. And I'm not an expert on grief. I do think that it's crazy that we don't, I mean, it's funny. I feel like I talk about it with people all the time, but the reason I get to talk to people about it all the time is because so many people are unprepared for it. And it is one of those disconnects because very few people expect to lose their sibling or their children, right? So that's the surprise. And the spouse also can be a very big surprise. But the one that is, you know, when life works the right way, if everything goes right, our grandparents, our parents are going to decease before us. And we still don't get each other ready for that. We still don't get each other ready for that. So when it happens, you're just like, whoa, somebody should have told me. And it's like, well, you know.
The only thing you're guaranteed in life is death. Like it is from the moment you are born. The only thing in this contract is there is a termination date.
Right. There's no other exit. Yes.
Every one of us. Right. And that means everyone we know and love. And, you know, as a parent now with a younger child, having to help him understand that. And I've been trying to normalize it from the very beginning with him. I don't shy away from talking about death. I talk about my own death. I talk about his death, not to scare him, but to normalize the fact that, you're not getting out of here, buddy. Nobody is.
Right. Nobody is.
This is the most human thing about living is death, right? Like that's it. Birth and death. That's it. You know, you can put taxes in there, but I think death is the true only guarantee. And yet we don't talk about it because it makes us so uncomfortable because we're all so afraid of our own mortality. And I'm not any less like afraid, but that doesn't mean that if I like avoiding it, what I have learned is avoiding it doesn't make the fear go away. No. It just makes it even scarier because now no one else is sharing in it with you. No one else is talking to you about it. So I think we have to talk about it and we don't. And instead what we do is because it makes us uncomfortable, we give everyone else a very brief window in which we allow them to be sad. And then we expect them to get back to normal. And grief doesn't work that way. My grief was years. And there are still moments that capture me and take my breath away where I'm caught off guard and like, it's been, like you said, over 10 years. And there are still those moments that get me. And that is not because I don't know what I'm doing or because I haven't grieved correctly or because I haven't faced it. Believe me, I have now. It is because that's how grief operates, right? It's for all of us. And this whole like avoiding it and because, oh, your tears are making me uncomfortable. So I'm going to give you 3 days of bereavement leave. Go home and cry for 3 days. And when you come back, you better be normal again because we can't handle it when you're not. And that bereavement leave doesn't even count for siblings, right? It doesn't count like usually the bereavement leave is for like a very few number of people in your family. And it's for most companies, it's 3 days and it doesn't matter if it's your kid. Then you get to use your PTO if you have any.
If you lose your job because
you can't show up crying every day. My husband, who's a high school counselor, was just telling me today they had a student, a sophomore, unfortunately, who died of leukemia over the weekend. And his sister's back at school. And he's like, ugh. And I said, you know what? His parents may not be able to be home with her.
Right.
You know, they may not have enough. They may have no bereavement leave. They may have to go to work so they can pay the bills. And then what are they supposed to do? They have to send their kid to school. It is, this country is just so, and we're not the only ones, the Western world, I think in general, but certainly in America, it's a real problem.
Sometimes also people make that decision in a variety of circumstances because, you know, the weight of grief moving through it every day.
I also mentioned that. Like sometimes you just need normalcy to like function. Because it can consume you. It can consume you. And that, you know, and again, there's privilege in even being able to take space. So 2 years of avoiding. And then I finally was like, I can't do this anymore. I destroyed a friendship because of my behaviors and how I was behaving. And I just had a moment where I finally looked at myself and said, this isn't me. This is not who I want to be. I don't want to be a 37-year-old who's out every night drinking until 2 a.m. And like, this is not where I thought my life would be. Yeah. Well, you know, the life I was living wasn't right, but this isn't what I left it for. This isn't it. Right. Like I finally had that clarity to say, something's got to change. And I knew the thing that had to change was I had to feel my feelings. I had to grieve. And I did have privilege to be able to go home, live with my mom. It didn't feel like a privilege being a 37-year-old woman going home and living with her mother, but there is a lot of privilege in that. Yes. And I was able to take 6 months because at that point, because of the 2009 recession with my grief, my work had dried up. I had gone from a six-figure business to making $13,000 the year after I got divorced or as I was getting divorced. I'd always made more than my ex-husband. Suddenly the year we're getting divorced, I was making no money. It was really, really hard. So I had to go back. I made barely any money. The money I made was just enough to like pay my car payment and, you know, their insurance, the things I had to take care of. My mom let me live there rent-free. Very, very lucky. It was not a big house, but ended up being the best thing for both of us. We both got to do a lot of grief. We got to do a lot of reconciliation between us that had been caused through all of that. I spent 6 months running. That was sort of how I felt my grief. I hit the pavement. And I just felt my feelings. I felt my body for the first time. Yeah. I felt my feelings. I cried. I journaled. And I really barely worked in those 6 months. And really all I did was just sit with my thoughts and cried and felt heavy. And that was the part of the process where I then was like, I don't know what I'm going to do now, but I've got to like start figuring something out because the journalism thing's not it. And what it had evolved into was like not what I wanted to do. It was so soul sucking work for me. It's great for people for whom it's great for, but for me, writing ad copy or, you know, writing blog posts for, at that time I was doing blog posts for like corporations that were selling like floor burnishing machines. Like it was just, it was like, what am I doing? And yes, I have to pay the bills. And like, I have a lot of life left, a lot of working life left, and this isn't doing it. And that whole process of figuring out, like slowly asking myself, and the first time in my life at 37, I was asking myself, what do I really want? Because again, I'd been a good girl. I always said I wanted to be a writer, but honestly, it was because of the gold stars. I was told I was good at it. I got lots of gold stars for writing. I was like, well, then I'm going to be a writer, right? Because it felt good to get all that praise, but I don't know that I ever really loved it. And so
really,
yeah, I don't think so. In fact, like most writers, I hated writing. I liked having written. Now, this is just how most writers show up in the world. Most writers, at least most writers I know, don't like writing. They like having written. Like the feeling of, here's this thing I just did. Isn't it amazing? That's great. But writing feels like torture often. And I was like, I don't want to torture myself anymore. Even if it could lead to whatever, prizes or anything. I'm like, I'm done trying to earn gold stars. I want to do something that feels good in the act of doing it. It was in that part of my life of like, I just want to do something that feels good, and slowly started to realize the thing that felt good, or what I thought would feel good, was helping other women who had been good girls stop having to be good girls without it having to look like death and divorce to make it happen, right? Like, I just really believe there had to be a way to start to shift out of that without your whole world having to crumble to do it. And so over time, that eventually, I never knew coaching was a thing. So first it started out as doing like fitness coaching, because I was at that time running a lot. And so I thought, oh, I'm doing this, I'll help other women with this. And then started to realize, like, I don't want to do this either, but I do love watching women start to feel powerful and feel good. And so eventually it morphed into what it is today, which is like business coaching and working with business owners. But that was sort of the beginning of that process. Was the grief is what led me to figuring out what I would do next.
So when you knew you had to cry, there is a funny body connection to like sweat, and movement is also helpful with big emotions. Because I'm not a doctor, but there's definitely there's something there, because
it's a somatic experience. Running, you get really in touch with your body. You start to learn, where does it hurt? Where can I push through? Where can I not? When do I need to listen? What are the cues I need to be listening for? What is my body trying to tell me? What's holding me back? And it's interesting to see, like, because at that time, like, you wouldn't know what to look at me now, but I mean, I was running I ran a marathon. I ran many half marathons. Like, I was running a lot, and I really learned like the ways that your mind can hold your body back, right? Or the ways your body can tell you your mind, there's something else here, right, that needs to move through you. It was the best healing.
Because we know that sadness can turn into sore muscles and stiffness in our body. And I think there's another part of that, which, you know, you can sort of, it's not a hack, but it's like, if you're having trouble connecting to those tears, it's like, go for a walk or a run and see if your body loosens up and if that emotion starts to pour through. And I think that I used to joke, I mean, I'm a lifelong runner, but I used to joke, I was like, if I don't feel better at the end of a 16-mile run, something is really, really, really wrong.
Yeah. I'm a walker now, not a runner, but yeah, I would, you know, you would go through all of that, and eventually your mind quiets down. Like, it was the only thing for me. It was very meditative, because I tried meditation back then and stuff too. And I'm still not very good at meditation, but movement becomes meditative, because eventually your brain starts to slow down. It runs out of, like, especially if you go long enough, all of the like, the spinning thoughts, and I have anxiety, so I have a lot of those. Eventually they kind of wear themselves out and you're still moving. And at some point your brain just starts to go like, okay, I guess I got to settle into this, right? And it does start to allow things to move through you. It also presents a lot of thoughts to you. I mean, the things I would think about on a run, like, you know, like, oh, especially if you run without music, but even with music, my brain would just be going. And it helped unearth so many things that I realized I needed to think about, feel, all of it. I mean, that was for me, that's what my grief work was. It was truly hitting the pavement every day.
So I remember I was maybe younger, but whenever Oprah told us to read the Eckhart Tolle book, The Power of Now, and in that book, he talks about, you know, when the only thing you focus on is your breath, which I've never been great at doing that when I'm sitting still in a room trying to do it. I can do it for a very brief amount of time, and then I'm, you know, thinking about my to-do list. But when I run, if I run long enough or hard enough, all I can think about is where the next breath is. And I remember I asked a Buddhist monk, this is like more than 25 years ago. I asked a Buddhist monk, I was like, well, do you think that running could be a meditation? And he was like, no, Jenna, I was like, okay. And then like decades later, I saw somebody talk about like walking meditation and moving meditation. I was like, ah, I feel so much better. I've been redeemed.
Vindicated. Yeah.
Totally
I don't like to
out.
Disagree with Buddhist monks, but I disagree very much after what I went through. So maybe that was just a monk who hadn't done a lot of running.
Maybe. I mean, whatever. And
I just want to be clear. I don't think running is the only solution, right? Like, I think it can look like walking. It can look like anything. I think the biggest thing was just that I gave myself time where I didn't have anything else. There were like, I couldn't come up with, there was no excuses. Like I wasn't able to just lose myself in work. And partially that was done to me because the economy and everything else, but also I had burned bridges through that time. Like there was, you know, it was a whole combination of things. And that space, again, such privilege to have it and be able to do that. But the quiet is what it took. It was like, I just had to have quiet. I took a week where I did an Airbnb at a, like a little lake with no Wi-Fi, no TV, and really forced it. I forced quiet and I did a lot of crying there and a lot of feeling. And that stuff was hard, but so, so important.
That is an amazing story. That's a huge amount of change in a relatively short period of time. When I was just reading the list before I even knew any of the details of what happened in the story, I wondered whether or not you had that sort of overwhelming feeling as you were going through this. Like, is my life just going to be one set of pain after the other? Or like, how did it feel in the moment when you were in the middle of it?
Daily.
Yeah.
There was a long period of time there where I was like, there was a lot of moments of, I don't want to say regret, but questioning, did I do the right thing? Because I could have lived the next 30 to 40 to 50 years of my life in a lot of stability, a lot of comfort, security. You know, I would have lived, I can still see what that life would have looked like. And it would have been real comfortable, would have been real cozy. It would have had a lot of travel, a lot of privileges. I wouldn't have worried. And I left that for a constant state of worry. I mean, money, particularly financial worry, but all the worries, like, will I be alone forever? Will I be able to pay my bills? Will I ever have friends again? Like all of it, because I felt so deeply isolated. And, you know, the funny thing is I moved back home where I grew up, but I left after college and I'm still here now. And I feel very disconnected from this place because I left for so long. I was gone for 15 years in a really important time, like after college, first jobs, whatever. And I am still self-employed. So friendships remain a challenge, in-person friendships. I have online friendships. But I had constant questions of, did I do the right thing? Is this all there ever will be?
Right. Did I do? Yeah, no, that's tough. It's been quite some time since all of these things happened. Share with us a little bit about what life looks like today and how things are better for you, hopefully.
They are. They are much better.
I didn't want to assume that, but I was like,
No, that's good. Well, so after that period of that, of sort of what comes next and figuring that out, then I slowly started to rebuild. I made a list of like what I wanted in a partner. And eventually that partner that list, everything is checked off with the person I'm now married to. I never thought I wanted kids. What I think I realized was I didn't want kids in that relationship. I now have a child who is the joy of my life by far. I mean, my partner is too. And then I am doing work that I really love. Like it, I don't have the financial security I had 20 years ago, which is a hard thing sometimes to sit with, to be a 50-year-old person who was more financially secure at 30, but I'm a whole lot happier. I love the work I'm doing every day. I'm not just doing it to get gold stars. I'm doing it because I love to do it. When the weekends are here, as much as I love my family, I'm counting down to Monday because I want to get back to work because I love my clients. I love the work I do. I love the podcast collective that I run. I love the fact that now my mission, which has evolved into not just helping women, it really still is. How do I help people, mostly women, stop being good girls, which really just means how do I help people break free of all that systemic stuff that causes us to perform so that we can live lives that actually mean something to us. And that is really everything I'm doing now. So it feels great.
That's spectacular. Okay. One more question, then we'll begin the wrapping up and the final questions. So Have you always identified as a feminist? Or, like, if I had met you when you were like 12 or 13, would you have said you already claimed that word?
Yes, I was reading Sassy Magazine back in the day.
Okay.
Shout out to Jane Pratt. I had a Ms. subscription at a very early age. I got to sit and do an interview in my college years with Gloria Steinem. We had tea together for 2 hours. One of the greatest moments of my life. But what I've realized in later part of my life, I was always a feminist. I had a very progressive mom who, which is shocking given her childhood and where she was from and her upbringing. What I learned though later in life was I was very much a white feminist. I didn't understand intersectionality. I didn't understand. I just sort of knew girl power. And what I have since learned is there is no girl power if it's only white girls who end up getting empowered, and that it really needs to be all of us or none of us. And that's what's shifted for me. So I've always identified as a feminist, but what that looks like now is radically different.
Very cool. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, because my video is frozen on me,
It
but I
is.
didn't know. So we're going to keep going. All right. You run a podcast collective. You have a podcast of yourself, Messy Liberation. You have a book coming out, which is called Liberate Your Business, which can be found at BeckyMollenkamp.com/book. And I'll put all those links in there. What's the best way that you want people to follow up with you after they are in the audience of this conversation?
Just go to BeckyMollenkamp.com. All the links are there. You can find out about the podcast collective if you have a show and want to join us. It's a great group of 50-ish, 50, around 50 members. We're all not all 50-ish, although you and I are, but we have members who are younger. But it's 50 or so podcasts that we get together and support each other through learning, sharing resources, and doing swaps with our shows. And then also, I'm very active on Threads, and you can find my link on my website for that as well.
Very cool. I don't have threads in my social list. I should probably add that. Are you ready for the final three questions?
I am.
All right. So I recently read the Book Club for Troublesome Women. I don't know if you've read it. It's fun.
I
Very.
have read it. We
Okay.
know. Did I read it? I don't know. It
Okay.
was it's in my queue if I haven't read it yet. I read almost 200 books last year, so I don't even remember what all I read.
Very cool. So in the book, they mention they all read the feminist mystique, the feminine
I have
mystique.
read it.
Have you read
Yes.
it? That was the question. If you
By
had read
Betty
it, sorry.
Friedan, I have read Feminine Mystique. Yes. I
All
read that a
right.
long time ago.
Yeah, because it's not a new book. Okay, so that was question number one. Question number two: if you won the Powerball lottery, which is an insane nutty amount of water money, when I
The
wrote the
billions
question,
these days, right?
when I checked it yesterday, it was $193 million.
Oh.
What is the first thing that you would buy for yourself if you won that? If you won that.
Are we talking after I pay off all our debt? Because that would be the first thing I would do.
Sure. After the debt, what's the first thing that you would buy yourself for fun?
A new car I'm gonna actually say, and this is gonna sound like I'm being selfless, but I'm not. I would buy my husband a new car only because he's never had a new car in his entire life, and I have had lots of them. But I would love to be able to buy him a brand new car. He's never had one. Oh,
All right.
that would bring me such joy.
That is a wonderful answer. All right. So, for some reason, I think that you are a person who enjoys musical theater. Do you enjoy musical
I
theater?
enjoy some musical theater.
All right, very good. So, what would you say is your all-time favorite musical theater show?
I am going to be so boring and so typically Gen X and say that it is Rent. However, my true favorite, like Rent is my like go-to. I love it. I could watch the movie a million times. I could listen to the soundtrack nonstop. But actually, my very favorite musical I've ever seen on Broadway with the original cast was called Spring Awakening, which most people don't know, but it won a bunch of Tonys that year. Lea Michele was one of the leads right before Glee. And the guy, Jonathan Groff, who's been in Hamilton, he won a Tony for his role in Hamilton. He was also in Spring Awakening. It was like their first big thing, and it was unbelievable. And the night that I saw it, Jimmy Fallon was sitting two seats in front of me. There were so many celebrities there because it was the night before the Tonys. And it was, I think maybe that is part of the reason it's my very favorite. But if anyone's never heard the music, it's really fantastic.
That was an amazing review for somebody who's not claiming the title of lover of all musical
I
theater.
used this was back when I had more wealth, my friend. That's when I was more into that stuff than I am now.
Very good. Thank you very much. That's it,
Thank
Becky
you.
Mollenkamp. This has been a wonderful interview.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.